city. I wanted them to feel pride in the city, while still validating their concerns. Duluth is both gritty and beautiful. It was my goal to get folks to take pride in that paradox. In the 1980s, he explained, it would be fair to say that Duluth was one of the 10 most distressed cities in the nation. Our peer cities back then were Flint and Gary and Youngstown. There was a fear that we'd get into a spiral and not be able to pull out. If Cirrus hadn't come, everything might have looked very different. Establishing the aviation sector was a critical turning point for our community, Ness said. It's highly skilled manufacturing. It requires a high level of employees, at both the shop floor level and in engineers. And it demonstrated this region's ability to create a new industry that it can support. As Joe Max Higgins might have put it, we're making shit that flies. Now, Ness said, the city didn't compare itself to any other city, but rather had discovered what he called the authentic niche for what Duluth on its own can be. This he defined as being a smaller mid-sized city with exceptional outdoor recreation opportunities and the natural beauty of the lake, with strong regional services like healthcare and higher ed, and a growing entrepreneurial economy. We're on the way.
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Well into our travels by now, we were getting a sense of a new measure for perspective on a town. That measure was through a town's art, a topic that doesn't come naturally to us. Jim and I are far from artists ourselves, much as I dream of how much fun that would be. But as the months of our travels became years, and we talked with more and more artists and planners and residents, we came to understand something about how the arts helped us, and residents and other visitors, see a town. Sometimes the art was celebratory and proud, like the bronze statues in Greenville or Rapid City or Holland that tell a story of the town. Sometimes we saw art confront the dark side, like the memorial to the lynching victims in Duluth, or the performances about the Civil War by the students in the Columbus, Mississippi Cemetery. Later, we would see how art unleashes the human capital of a town, which lay ahead in Fresno, or attracts and allows creative energy to synergize and flourish, as in the artists' co-ops of the Franklinton area of Columbus, Ohio, or builds the civic strength of a town, which we would find among a new generation in San Bernardino, or is the basis for entire renewal of a town, like in Ajo, Arizona. We also came to recognize many cases where art is functional and just plain fun, as in Bend, Laramie, Erie, Sioux Falls, Dodge City, and many other towns where art was bicycle racks, benches, fountains, decorative wall murals, and more. Two towns in the Midwest swing taught us two new perspectives on the scope and impression art can make. One insight came from Pittsburgh, the other from Charleston, West Virginia. Pittsburgh has long been a deeply philanthropic town, and much of its philanthropy has focused on enriching lives through the arts, with its big-ticket endeavors like museums, galleries, outdoor spaces, pleasant access to an attractive riverfront, stadiums, and theaters. Pittsburgh is known for its big-scale art. The city now has only half as many residents as it did during its heavy industrial prime, but it has retained a concentration of locally minded philanthropies from its richest days, Carnegie, Mellon, Heinz, Frick, which have kept up its museums and concert halls. It has the cultural infrastructure of a city of 1 million residents, with only one-third that many people competing to enjoy them. Amid all that, we came upon something artistically unique, something that has, I would say, brought a new sense of compassion to its people. The City of Asylum sits in a close-in north side section of Pittsburgh, known as the Mexican War Streets. Many of the streets there are named for battles or generals from the Mexican-American War. The gentrified Bohemian row house neighborhood is home to many writers, artists, and eclectic personalities. In 2003, Henry Reese and Diane Samuels established the City of Asylum, an organization, for lack of a more precise word, that provides sanctuary for exiled at-risk writers. Reese and Samuels pulled together donors and friends and bought a former crack house on a small lane called Sampsonia Way and fixed it up. City of Asylum now owns several houses in a row. The lane feels like a Midwestern version of a hutong in old Beijing. Their first exile writer was Huang Xiang, a poet from Hunan province, also the native province of Mao Zedong. Huang Xiang became an advocate for democracy and human rights during the Cultural Revolution and was sent to a labor camp for 3 years in 1986 for disturbing social order. He fled China with his wife in 1997 and was granted asylum in the United States. He arrived at Sampsonia Way in 2004. The years of hardship and punishment had cost him broken bones, much of his hearing, and many of his teeth, but not his spirit or his poems, which his wife had squirreled away for safekeeping. When Huang Xiang arrived in Pittsburgh and took a look at Mount Washington, he said that in the tradition of the Chinese poets, he would like to carve a poem into the mountainside. Samuels didn't blanch, but she suggested instead he might paint his poems on the outside of his house. They set up scaffolding around the frame house, and Huang went to work, painting his poems in his own grass-style calligraphy. He was writing his house, he said. The neighbors, of course, couldn't help but notice house poem. Before long, neighbors who didn't understand even a word of Huang's Chinese poetry began to slip notes through his mail slot, many with poems they had written themselves. The City of Asylum began to grow and thrive. Five more writers arrived from El Salvador, Burma, Venezuela, Iran, and Bangladesh, all with stories as dramatic as Huang Xiang's. There were concerts and readings open to the public by more than 300 artists. The events spilled out onto the street and vacant lots and under tents. There were projects involving the neighborhood community, including one called River of Words. Exiled Venezuelan writer and poet Israel Centeno, a City of Asylum resident, created a community-generated public art installation within the Mexican War streets. He chose 100 words, relevant in some way to Pittsburgh. Neighbors were invited to host a word in residence, meaning that they would display a representation of their word on a wall or a door or window of their house. Visual artists Carolina Arnal and Gisela Romero fabricated the words and traveled from Venezuela to install them. River of Words was wildly popular. "Vortex! I need to have vortex!" claimed one neighbor. "Baseball!" claimed another. "Fear, talent, thought." The list went on. When we walked the streets around Sampsonia Way, we spotted the words, some bold, some inconspicuous, stenciled on garage doors or sitting above garden gates. The City of Asylum has since developed a corner lot into a reading garden and renovated the long-abandoned Masonic Hall just down the street for musical and literary performances and films, a bookstore, a restaurant, and apartments and offices. Next up, they have an eye on former Salvation Army buildings. We met Huang Xiang when he returned after his years on Sampsonia Way for the 10th anniversary program for the City of Asylum. He recited his poem, Wild Beasts. Or to put it more accurately, he didn't just recite the poem, he danced, shouted, waved, and lived that poem with his whole body and spirit. By the end, the entire audience was exhausted with him. It seems natural that the City of Asylum should also thrive in Pittsburgh. The residents of the town were warmed up to appreciate and participate in such an edgy and ambitious artistic effort. The City of Asylum started out offering sanctuary to exiled artists, and it ended up bringing compassion to a city. The story of Charleston is entirely different. It illustrates what happens when a town and its art make for synergy.
Charleston, West Virginia. In the early 1970s, a young singer-songwriter named Larry Gross was launching his career in the music business. He had grown up in Oak Cliff, a working-class district of Dallas, moved to Los Angeles, started recording albums, and in 1976 had a top 10 hit with the novelty song Junk Food Junkie. After that song came out, Dick Clark invited Gross onto his then very popular American Bandstand show. When Gross finished singing, Clark interviewed him about the idea behind the junk food song, but then asked him about his odd-sounding job title, which was Musician in Residence for the State of West Virginia. A few years earlier, when he was 24 and trying to get established in his career, Gross had heard from a friend about a federal program to send musicians to rural areas. "I first thought, do they want me to do a concert in West Virginia?" he told us when we met him in his house in the capital city of Charleston. "They said, no, this is where you go live there for 9 months. I was in L.A. looking for something different, so I tried it." And he never left. "I'd already made 3 albums, and I thought I could turn this into a career," he said. "When I was here, I started wondering if I could actually do that from West Virginia, if I had representation elsewhere. That's why I came, and when I got here, I found that it fit me, personally." After that half-accidental introduction to West Virginia, in the early 1970s, Gross stayed, and he became one of the major artistic and pop cultural forces in the state. He continued his recording career. By the time we met him in late 2014, he had finished his 23rd album, the latest in a list that includes several very successful children's albums for Disney. Since 2005, he had been the director of Festival, an annual 10-day arts festival in Charleston. In the 1980s, he owned and ran a ballet school in Morgantown. And for more than 30 years, he has been the host of, and a performer on, the weekly National Public Radio music show, Mountain Stage. Mountain Stage is the main national media production coming out of West Virginia, and it has been a significant force in country music. It was carried by 150 stations nationwide at the time of our visit, and in the next 2 years it expanded to 200. The list of artists who had their first live broadcast exposure to a national audience under Gross's auspices is so long and impressive that at first I didn't really believe it, but then I checked it out. The performers include Lyle Lovett, Mary Chapin Carpenter, Sheryl Crow, Bare Naked Ladies, Alison Krauss, Annie DeFranco, Fish, Counting Crows, Lucinda Williams, and many more. We got to see a live Mountain Stage performance at the Civic Center in downtown Charleston before an enthusiastic and youngish full house crowd, with Bob and Suzanne Caulfield of Charleston, he a lawyer, she an educator, who introduced us to many of the backstories of Charleston. It was 2 hours of music by a range of established and rising artists. James McMurtry, a singer-songwriter whom I first met when he was a teenager, hanging around in his father Larry's bookstore in Washington, ended the show. Before him came the acoustic rock-folk jazz band The Devil Makes Three, based in California, and the progressive bluegrass group Yonder Mountain String Band from Colorado. And opening the evening, for a bewitching 20-something minutes, were two teenage sisters from Indiana, Lily and Madeline, who were just on their way up at that point and became much more popular in the following years. "They've got that sibling harmony," Gross said when introducing them on the show. "There's no substitute." A few days after the show, we went to see Gross and his family at their house, both to ask him about the program's history, but also because his name frequently came up when we asked people in Charleston, "Who makes this town go?" West Virginia in general, and the Kanawha Valley region around Charleston, are, of course, places where not enough has gone right for quite a long time. The coal industry has inevitably shrunk and is shrinking further. The big processing works that once gave the area the name Chemical Valley are mainly gone. Other corporate headquarters have left, and the leading employers in the Charleston area are now the hospitals. So what was it like to run a recording career from here, and to produce a national radio show from a state usually the object of condescension from coastal big city tastemakers? 2 themes ran through what Gross told us over the next hour or two. One was about the possibilities and challenges of doing first-tier creative work in what the world considers second- or third-tier locations. This was obviously a major theme through all of our travels. Whether they come out and say it or not, many of the country's most ambitious people assume that work of a certain level requires being in a certain place. This idea of a vast national sorting system for talent has huge ramifications. They range from politics to the distortion of real estate prices in a handful of coastal big cities. But as we continue to find, in countless other places across the country, people don't have to start out assuming that most of what they take home will immediately go out for rent or mortgage. That is because they have calculated that in Duluth and Greenville and Redlands and Holland and Sioux Falls and Burlington and Allentown and even larger places like Columbus, Ohio and Charleston, they can build their company, pursue their ambition, and realize their dream without crowding into the biggest cities. Some people have always preferred the small-town life. Of course, America has always had diverse regional centers. And, of course, locational concentration matters in many industries. I had known that before we started these travels. What I hadn't known is how consistently and across such a wide range we would find people pursuing first-tier ambitions in what big-city people would consider the sticks. As for Larry Gross, when he first got to West Virginia, he said he found it comfortable because the way people here looked, acted, and even sounded reminded him of his grandparents and great-aunt's generation in Texas, which made sense since many Texans of that era had migrated from Appalachia. As he stayed, he came to appreciate its practicality, its lack of pretension, and its person-to-person level of generosity. Practicality, he said, it's one of those places that has never had a boom, so booms and busts are relative. If you're never up, you can't be down. Lack of pretension, he said, lots of people can make an album in the studio who can't do it live. Mountain Stage is recorded before a live audience. That is very West Virginia, too, to deliver in person. We have hillbillies, but we'll tell you what a hillbilly is. You outsiders don't tell us. This was 2 years before J.D. Vance's book, Hillbilly Elegy, made the term a staple of political conversation. He said, a hillbilly isn't an ignorant fool. He's a straightforward, self-effacing, what-you-see-is-what-you-get person. He relies on his friends because he doesn't trust a lot of other things. He's not necessarily formally educated, but he is smart. Generosity, Gross said. If your car gets broken down, you want it to happen in West Virginia. This whole stuff about deliverance, it's just the opposite. If something happens, you want it to happen here. People will stop and help. Gross told the story of a national news correspondent who came to interview people nearby and found them unwilling to answer questions. So he put up the hood of his car as if he were having engine trouble, and people came over to help him out and talk with him. How does that affect his show? Gross seemed content with and proud of his show and its cultural reach, but he was fully aware that, since it is a national show, we have felt stereotypes people have about West Virginia. He said, one thing I've learned over the years, when you put mountain in the title of something, people think you're in the fiddle and banjo show, which we're not. Of course, if we were just an old-timey bluegrass country show, we'd probably get more national press, since we'd fit expectations. We see the expectations in the stories that are generated about this place. Have a mine disaster? The reporters are all here. Have a chemical spill? All here. Have something where it shows that some percentage of the children are poor or obese? Yes. But if you have Gabriel Kahane and Kate Miller-Heidke on one show, and then James McMurtry, it doesn't fit the categories. Doesn't make sense. If I am making Gross sound defensive in recounting this, I'm misrepresenting him. His tone was like that of a politician who understands anthropologist style, that the press simply can't help concentrating on elections, rather than governing, but nonetheless realizes that his or her job comes down to governing. And the second theme Larry Gross reminded us of? His sense that West Virginia and Charleston, for all their travails, were moving in the right, rather than the wrong, direction. How do the state's prospects compare with when he first arrived, we asked. Lots of people who are older are looking backward, he said. 50 years ago, there were 80,000 people in Charleston. Now there are 50,000. Back then, Union Carbide employed a lot of people with advanced degrees who made good money. So people can get stuck in, I remember when... Coal is dying, but it's like a dangerous animal that's dying. It's going to thrash. However, he said, younger people, as well as those from elsewhere, didn't have that memory. They were starting new businesses and families and projects. I think in the last 10 years, there's been a renaissance, he said. It's easy to go to a place because the money is good. It's different because you like being there. I am optimistic about this place. 2015. In the air. Winter was coming. We wanted a way to keep traveling, despite the ice and wind and snow, and to extend our reporting beyond the eastern half of the country. It was time to head west. In the last weeks of 2014, for Western Travels the following year, which we're reporting here as the introduction to what we saw and learned in 2015. Potomac Clearance, Cirrus 435 Sierra Romeo. Ready to copy clearance, IFR, from Gaithersburg to Huntington, West Virginia. Hotel, Tango, Sierra. We sat on the runway at Montgomery County Air Park in Gaithersburg, our normal base near Washington, preparing for a long trip to the west. We'd allowed plenty of time to reach our destination before nightfall, even though now, in late November 2014, night was coming early, and even though, as we headed west across the Appalachians, we were likely to be buffeted by headwinds the whole way. We'd come out to the airport in plenty of time to weigh the baggage piece by piece, to make sure it was situated for the right weight and balance distribution between the rear seat and the luggage compartment in the tail, and to allow for careful checks of the oil level, the tire pressure, the updated navigation software. It was only around noon, but with every hour it was getting later and darker and colder. The preceding winter had been historically cold across the eastern half of the United States, as a polar vortex settled much further south than normal and brought Arctic temperatures to much of the Midwest and the East Coast. On one of our visits to Greenville, South Carolina, the Reedy River had had a layer of ice, and the fountain in front of the downtown Poinsett Hotel had been frozen solid. Even southern Georgia had suffered a frost. From a climate scientist's point of view, this was one more sign of disruption in expected weather patterns. The Arctic was warmer than normal, pushing the vortex further south. From our point of view, it was one more reason to try to get south and west before the upcoming winter and the forecast of more polar vortices set in. That was the large-scale strategic reason to get away from the eastern seaboard. The tactical one was an imminent snowstorm. If we could put 1,000 miles between ourselves and the East Coast within the next day or two, we would escape the widely forecast crippling blizzard and whited-out cities between the Appalachians and the Atlantic Ocean. Finally, the controller from Potomac Clearance radioed back our authorized route, altitude, and takeoff time for the start of the trip to the west. 435 Sierra Romeo is cleared to the Hotel Tango Sierra Airport. He was using the phonetic term for HTS, the code for our destination airport in Huntington, West Virginia. VIA, on entering controlled airspace, direct Westminster VOR, then expect radar vectors. It was a formula I knew and had anticipated and had already entered into the plane's navigation equipment. I listened for the crucial words about the allowable takeoff window. Cleared for takeoff. Clearance void if not off by time 16:35. Time now, 16:30. We had 5 minutes to get to the runway and go. We went. Over the Appalachians, the winds were stiff, the bumps were significant. The sky around us was gray and white with clouds. This is the kind of flying that amounts to getting there rather than enjoying it. But the temperature outside remained several degrees above freezing, just as forecast, and as necessary so that the annoyance of a slow, bumpy ride did not become the serious danger of ice on the wings. The Appalachians are not stark and steep by the standards of such western ranges as the Sierras, the Cascades, the Tetons, or of course the Rocky Mountains. Nevertheless, their often difficult weather and winds demand attention. An hour into the flight, we'd finally crossed the mountains, and starting at Elkins, West Virginia, we could begin a slow descent to warmer temperatures and less ferocious winds as we traversed the state. We broke free of the clouds as we crossed over Charleston, West Virginia again, where the airport is named for native son Chuck Yeager. We headed as planned for the Tri-State Airport in Huntington, on the banks of the Ohio River, where the states of West Virginia, Kentucky, and Ohio all abut. We'd gotten the last room in the motel, which was full of utility repair and tree service crews from across the Midwest who were being deployed in anticipation of the blizzard that would hit the following day. The next morning, trying our best to stay ahead of the storm, we headed west across Kentucky. Nearly 2 hours into that next day's trip, the weather was fine and the headwinds had weakened. But suddenly, one of the 6 cylinders was showing a different temperature from the other 5. Suddenly, the engine seemed to be running a little rough. Suddenly, it was time to land and find out what was going on. 10 minutes' flight ahead of us was the airport in Murray, Kentucky, not far from the Missouri border and the home of Murray State University. We landed and taxied over to a maintenance shop, one of whose staffers, we learned, was, again fortunately, an Atlantic reader who had been following our travels across the country. I said that I thought a spark plug might have failed. The head maintenance man said he could check, and if that was indeed the problem, he could probably fix it within an hour or two. He suggested that we drive into town for lunch. We borrowed the crew car, a veteran white Crown Vic that had previously been a police cruiser, complete with spotlights on both sides. 90% of the time in small airports around the country, when there was a crew car, it was a former police cruiser Crown Vic. We climbed into this one and drove into the old downtown for grilled cheese sandwiches at Rudy's on the square. If it had been 2 years later, we might have felt obliged as visiting journalists to ask others here on the fringes of coal country about Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Instead, we asked some residents about their town, and we mainly heard about new improvements at Murray State. As we'd noted so many times, when we asked people what was on their minds, we'd hear about schools or drugs or downtown redevelopment projects or new companies that might come to town. Virtually never did anyone volunteer the staple themes from national politics. Do we trust the media? Which party do we dislike more? That came to dominate so much of the national news, and that are usually the first and last questions visiting reporters ask. Back to the airport, and a failure of the spark plug on cylinder number 3 diagnosed and repaired. Off again towards the west, across Missouri, and on to Little Rock for an overnight stay and dinner with our dear friend and longtime Atlantic editor William Whitworth, who had grown up in Little Rock during the days of its school desegregation showdowns, then spent decades in New York and Boston as a jazz musician and a writer and editor with The New Yorker and then The Atlantic, and had returned to his home there. On the way to Little Rock, we encountered a cloud bank just as we were crossing the Mississippi from Tennessee to Arkansas. But we got a pop-up clearance to proceed on instrument flight rules. We kept going across rice fields and the catfish ponds of the flat Arkansas Delta lands. And 50 miles outside of Little Rock, we came into clear, calm air for an easy descent. The weather stayed clear as we kept heading west the next day. It was bright and cold and windy, a steady plains wind in our face as we went across Arkansas and into Oklahoma. It was a Thursday morning as we took off from Little Rock, the fourth Thursday in November, Thanksgiving Day. Our two sons were with their in-laws in California, one in Los Angeles, one in Santa Barbara. We missed them. We were headed westward, but were only halfway across the continent from where they all were. We were intent on a destination within Oklahoma, the very small town of Guymon. We'd planned an intermediate stop in the also-small town of Okmulgee, which we'd chosen for its big runways and cheap gas. As we neared that airport and listened to the local air traffic control frequency, the only other plane we heard was a Cessna Caravan, a durable freight-hauling plane, doing practice takeoffs and landings there. Over the airwaves, we could identify by voice one grizzled-sounding American, who we assumed was the flight instructor, and two young students who, by their accents, seemed to be from Africa. When we landed and were refueling our plane, we saw them land a few hundred yards away, close enough to judge their appearance, not enough to meet or talk. Our guess was that the trainees were preparing for their commercial pilot licenses. Small airports all over America have foreign pilots in training because the costs are lower and the facilities better here than anywhere else. This would probably afford the two young men some nice employment opportunities, perhaps as commercial pilots, or perhaps as the freight pilots known as freight dogs, if they went back home.
Guymon, Oklahoma. Guymon had been on our map since we'd first come across Caroline Henderson. The Atlantic had published a series of letters Henderson had written from Guymon in the 1930s to a friend back in Maryland, describing her life and experience on her family's rural farm as the drought unfolded and persisted. The Atlantic called these letters from the Dust Bowl. Her farm was a most anticipated destination for us on this journey. We landed in Guymon on Thanksgiving Day, with high winds tearing across the flat, flat land in the early afternoon. The FBO manager had finished his turkey already, and was back at the airport with a really nice crew car for us to borrow overnight. We don't mean to keep dwelling on crew cars at the fixed base operators, but they loom as a large factor in our travels. In many of the small towns where we land, like Eastport, there are no taxis and no car rentals. This was also the case in Guymon. In the middle of nowhere, especially on a Sunday or holiday, you can find yourself with nowhere to go but back into your plane. So we were particularly thankful for the generosity of the FBO operator on this Thanksgiving Day. I had tracked down Henderson's apparently only living relative. Caroline and her husband Will had one daughter, Eleanor, who had one son, David Grandstaff, now a geologist and geochemist. His profession struck me as fitting somehow, related as he was to a heritage of the earth. Grandstaff recounted for me his visits to his grandparents' farm in the 1950s and 1960s. He'd spent summers and Christmases there when he was a boy. He also gave me the exact location of the farm, both the latitude and longitude, and the road location, in the community known as Eva. The farm was at the intersections of Road N and 9. The alpha and numeric at first sounded odd, and later became comforting for being logical waypoints to keep us oriented along the straight, endless, otherwise marker-free roads in rural Oklahoma. Grandstaff warned me that the farm would look pretty desolate, not the way it used to. We could be sure to recognize it, he noted, by the barn with the fallen-down roof. Indeed, we discovered that there was more. The front porch of the house was gone, the doors and windows were gone, or boarded up. We peered in where we could. Inside the dark rooms were some ghostly remains of a sofa and some chairs, an old fridge, a fine piece of cabinetry in the dining room which Will Henderson had surely made, since he'd built the whole house. We could see the steps going up to the second floor, but even from afar they didn't look trustworthy any longer. The barn without its roof was otherwise intact, and we found remains of outbuildings, one of which was probably a chicken coop that Henderson had written about, and the footprint of others. There was barren land as far as we could see. We unintentionally disturbed flocks of quail from the scrubby turf and saw an elegant hawk cruising aloft, as well as a bird that Jim swore was a great horned owl. There was no sign of the schoolhouse across the road where Henderson had first taught when she moved to Oklahoma after college at Mount Holyoke. Her dream of farming the land had coincided with the years of drought and dust, but Grand Staff reminded us of the decades of successful farming and pleasure Caroline and Will had enjoyed on their farm before the dark years of the Dust Bowl descended. Indeed, they had farmed since about 1908. When I asked him why he thought they'd stuck out the drought for the duration, it lasted nearly the entire decade, he said he imagined they'd had no real alternative, since everything they had was in that land. And who would ever have guessed that the drought would persist for so long? We drove back some 20 miles, and what felt like most of a century, from the Henderson's farm at the crossroads in Eva to Guymon, where we searched with dwindling hope for some remnants of a turkey dinner. Nope, every restaurant was closed, we were told by the clerk at the Comfort Inn, the owner of a Mexican grocery, and the minder of the gas station, which had a few leftover chicken sandwiches in its cooler. We raced to the Walmart and were met at 5:30 p.m. by residents from miles around who were lined up with their carts along every last aisle, with store employees standing guard to enforce traffic rules in the yellow-taped thoroughfare aisles. They were all ready for the 6 p.m. official start of Black Friday sales. We were warned to move out quickly. We grabbed a six-pack of Tecate. Then we found a lone quick food shop open and purchased two frozen burritos to microwave back at the Comfort Inn. Our Thanksgiving.
This part of the country is now connected to the nation and the world in a way hard to imagine when the Hendersons were fighting dust and drought and despair. Yet even now, the area has the distinct sense of being very, very far away from anything and very much on its own. I found myself surprisingly moved by seeing the house in which Carolyn wrote her chronicles of a terrible stage in the country's history, the very land that she and her husband and their daughter fought to preserve, let alone the improbability of the letter she wrote at her desk in the same room we peered at through blown-out windows, making their way to editors in Boston who made them known across the country. Most of us fancy ourselves brave and independent in various ways, but to have even this rough idea of where and how these families lived through all those years gives a different meaning to the words courage and independence.
Ajo, Arizona. The word remote became vivid to us during our time in Ajo. The town in southwestern Arizona, population around 3,500, stands alone, surrounded by federal lands. To the east is the main reservation of the Tohono O'odham Nation, bigger than Delaware, smaller than Connecticut, and home to roughly 10,000 residents. To the south is the vast swath that FDR set aside as the Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument in 1937, and beyond that, Mexico. And to the west is the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge. The closest town, Gila Bend, considered just a hop up the road, is a 40-mile drive north through sparse desert with hill and mountain views in the distance. At night, we saw more stars than we knew were in the heavens. The quiet was broken by cries of what we imagined were small feral animals and by the occasional A-10 training flights darting through the skies of the Barry M. Goldwater Range, the nation's third-largest bombing range. To add a city folk measure, the town has one stoplight, we had no cell coverage, and the nearest car rental we could find was in Phoenix, more than 100 miles away.
Ajo has a small airport, which is unusual in that the town is almost entirely surrounded by various forms of restricted airspace. The most restricted of these to the city's north is known as R2305, the Barry M. Goldwater Range, where A-10s, F-16s, and other aircraft conduct day and night bombing and strafing drills. That's not so odd in itself. Much of the West is covered by military airspace, and you talk with the air traffic controllers to figure out when and how you can safely and legally cross. But this one, on the way to Ajo, was more stringent than usual. I called a couple of flight service officials and asked how to make the transit. They all said they didn't know. Then I prowled around online and found an account from someone who had flown all the way into Ajo a few years earlier. The punchline was that you can fly to the airport as long as you follow a narrow state highway that edges along the Air Force Range, all the while staying in contact with a military air traffic controller called Snake Eye and remaining over the road exactly 500 feet above the ground, which is very low. Contact Snake Eye? Follow a road for 40 miles over terrain I'd never seen before and where jagged formations pop up all over at 500 feet above the ground? Report passing between two peaks at an altitude below their summits and then craters, all the while with A-10s roaring around? The pilot whose account I read was exhilarated by his trip. It was a beautiful day for flying. I had an opportunity to experience the State Route 85 corridor with an active restricted area and a strafing run down the highway. It does not get much better than this. I decided it would be better to land at the last little airport outside the bombing zone, Gila Bend Municipal, and see how the road to Ajo looked from ground level.
Many people assume that the name Ajo comes from the Spanish word for garlic, but it's actually more likely an Indian-derived word for the red pigmented soil, ojo. Ajo thrived as a copper mining town for most of the 20th century. Around 1911, the Calumet and Arizona Mining Company confirmed a large high-grade copper carbonate ore body, located a nearby water well, and developed a way to process the ore. The company hired a mining executive named John Greenway, a former Rough Rider with Teddy Roosevelt at the Battle of San Juan Hill, and Yale football star, to develop the New Cornelia mine. He was joined by his adventurous young wife, Isabella. By 1917, Ajo's open-pit, oval-shaped mine, a mile and a half across and more than 1,000 feet deep, nearly as deep as the structure of the Empire State Building is tall, was in full production. Greenway was inspired by the City Beautiful movement of the era to build a well-planned town, managed in a socially responsible way. Ajo was noticed and referenced in journals of the early 1900s as a model company town. Ajo's town plaza was and still is an oasis, a broad expanse of green lawns surrounded on three sides by a Spanish colonial revival-style arcade of shop fronts, whitewashed and shaded by red tile-roofed walkways. At the far end is the train station. The now-closed rail line connected Ajo to Gila Bend, where it then linked to the Southern Pacific Sunset Route. Across the street from the west end of the plaza are a pair of churches painted bright white, one Catholic and one Methodist. Palm trees are everywhere. The residential part of the town was more modest. Housing for the mine workers was divvied up according to ethnicity, a system that, a century later, has brought the model town description under more critical scrutiny. The Anglos lived in the houses closest to town, and many of those houses still stand today. You can see some of the small slabs where the houses of Mexican Town and Indian Village once stood. St. Catherine's Indian Mission is now home to the town's history museum. There were fully stocked company-run shops, schools, and all kinds of activities and cultural celebrations. Today's Ajo kids still lament the long-gone movie theater. People also recollect that the swimming pool was segregated by ethnicity back then, and the Indians' Day was the last one before the pool's weekly draining and cleaning. The Greenway's house, elegant but unpretentious, still presides on the top of the hill overlooking Ajo. Fast forward nearly seven decades. The New Cornelia mine had suffered from bitter labor disputes, as well as from the diving price of copper. The owners shut down the mine in 1985. What followed was a brutal and humbling collapse for the showpiece desert town. The population plummeted. Houses and shops were left to bake in the sun. A trickle of old and new businesses have kept the town alive, including the community newspaper, the Ajo Copper News, run by Gabrielle David, the editor, and her brother Hop, the publisher. Before them, their mother Anne and father Richard were editor and publisher, respectively. There are longtime locals, snowbirds, and retirees from the north. Tourists and campers are big SUVs on their way to the Mexican border or the Organ Pipe Cactus National Monument, and some survivalists. A number of Border Patrol families live in Ajo in the new pastel-colored houses built by the U.S. government especially for them. There are warning signs not to trespass onto their streets. The prominent Border Patrol headquarters is about 10 miles southeast of Ajo, and there's an all-vehicle compulsory road stop station on the way to Gila Bend. We were waved through each time after a few cursory questions and a quick look into our car. Outlaws traverse the desert. Migrants and traffickers hide there. And while some people set out barrels of water marked with flags for those who need it, others report them. You see the occasional lone parked trailer that looks like something out of Breaking Bad. Border Patrol vehicles are a constant presence on and off the roads through the desert around Ajo. There is no mistaking them. Driving south into town, past the rural equivalent of strip malls, are a motel, a gas station, a few restaurants and RV parks, a supermarket, an Elks Lodge, and lots of chances to buy Mexican car insurance. Then, rounding the corner into Ajo proper, you come upon the stunning town plaza with its palm trees and whitewashed buildings. Among the plaza shops today are a deli, a second-hand store, a gym, the library, a restaurant abandoned like a ghost ship, its tables still set with white tablecloths and stemmed wine glasses, and a grocery store that sells expired goods at an incredibly cheap price. We couldn't resist sneaking into the expired goods store during our visits for opportunistic shopping. Past date granola bars? Old soap? How bad could they be? In 1993 came the beginning of a turning point for Ajo. A trinational group of leaders from Ajo, the nearby Mexican town of Sonoita, and the Tohono O'odham Nation convened out of a concern for the Sonoran Desert, the environment they all shared. They called themselves the International Sonoran Desert Alliance, ISDA. For 10 years, ISDA met with residents of all three nations, the United States, Mexico, and Tohono. While remaining steeped in deep respect for the original mission of preserving the desert environment, it eventually shifted its focus to the economic development of their region through arts and culture. ISDA and a multitude of local groups it has spawned have built a complex ecology of arts, environment, gardens, real estate, business development, health, and job training and employment that is leading the town toward a stable future. One key to ISDA's and Ajo's forward motion has been the stewardship of Tracy Taft, an energetic yet understated former community organizer and educator from back east. She had already seen potential reach fruition in many other communities. Taft first came to Ajo to retire and to work as an artist with glass. She joined the ISDA board and became its executive director in 2003, tapping into her network of helpful friends and colleagues and wending deftly through bureaucracies to win countless grants and support for ISDA from foundations, nonprofits, and government agencies. Two major efforts have been the cornerstones of Ajo's sustainability: the renovations of the town plaza, and a few blocks uphill, the repurposing of the mining-era Curley School campus. The project at the Curley School, named for Mike Curley, who was John Greenway's successor as the mine supervisor, began with the renovation of a few buildings into modestly priced rental units for artists, sculptors, painters, photographers, dancers, and artisans of all sorts. When you walk around the tiny front yard spaces of the living quarters, You see stone sculptures, installations hanging from tree branches, and small decorative gardens. All evidence of indoor art spilled outdoors into the communal space. The resident artists do much of their work in the campus studios and workshops. Some sell their work in the gallery in the downtown plaza. One supplements her income with French bread she bakes for the town's Saturday market. People with an artistic bent have always been attracted to Aho. A lot of them said it was because of the light or the panorama of the desert. We joined some of them for an impromptu happy hour out in the desert one evening, taking in the changing colors of the sunset over the dry hills and flatlands. Aho is also attractive for being inexpensive. The asking price for a top-of-the-line house is under $175,000. A modest one goes for half that, and fixer-uppers for as little as $25,000. You can't walk a block without running into sculptures of stone and metal, random fancy tiles, mosaics, hanging art, or extraordinary benches to rest on. People paint murals on walls and in entire alleys, from small to building size. Others craft creative railings or fences around their houses or gardens. Visiting artists offer programs and classes, puppet makers, clowns and jugglers and mimes, basket weavers, bead workers, potters, quilters, and fiddlers. If we had stayed on, I know I would have begun to feel a little guilty, or at least left out, if I weren't contributing to the creative culture. I was thinking about jewelry or a delicate herb garden, and Jim could brew beer. A new creation to reconcile part of Aho's past is a tall concrete wall along the wedge of Triangle Park. Set into the wall are photographs, mosaics, and text to commemorate the mining-era residents whose lives came up short in sharing the prosperity and privilege of the times, the Mexicans and American Indians. More renovations at the Curley School followed. At the top of the campus are the former elementary school classrooms, surrounding a courtyard. The business plan called for an income-producing conference center, with classrooms converted into guest rooms, meeting rooms, and cooking facilities. The outdoor play space would be desert-friendly gardens to supply produce, and a hen house for egg-laying chickens. The construction was done by local workers, who are part of an ISDA apprenticeship program. The apprentices learn their skilled trades, do the work of the renovations, earn formal credentials, and emerge as ready-for-hire workers. The town has plenty of need for their services, such as addressing the stock of sorely aging housing, as well as the town's school, clinic, library, and other public buildings. Some workers became bona fide artisans. One man designed and made intricate hanging lamps for the guest rooms out of old industrial metal fluorescent ceiling lights, popular in school buildings during the Curley era. We stayed in one of the newly completed guest rooms. A group of a dozen young volunteers with the AmeriCorps National Civilian Community Corps, NCCC, were in residence, assembling beds, moving furniture, and painting many more rooms. They were smitten with Aho, and vice versa. Aaron Cooper has been at ISDA since 2010 and was a teacher at the Tohono O'odham Reservation High School for 5 years before that. Recently, Cooper took over Taft's executive duties. We met Stuart Siegel and Emily Rain and their dog, Bo, who first stopped by Aho on more or less a whim on their classic cross-country trip in their station wagon. They stuck around for a bit, despite Bo getting himself into considerable trouble while chasing a javelina into a cactus, and offered to help open the new conference center as volunteers. 2 months later, they were weighing an offer from ISDA to direct the new conference center, which was still under construction. Aho probably seemed farther away than 2,000 miles from their former East Coast bustle, but Emily and Stuart decided to sign on. They were married about a year later in Aho, now have a native-born Arizonan son, Jonah, and have moved from a rental to a house of their own. Aho needs more young people and families like those of ISDA to find their way there and settle down and help build the 21st century Aho. Jane Cannon, a registered nurse at the Desert Sunita Community Health Center, said she worried about who will replace her when she retires. Finding teachers for the school is a challenge. The excellent band teacher had to leave when her husband, who works for the Border Patrol, was transferred. We heard that the cafe had recently changed to a new young ownership. Maybe someone will open a microbrewery one day. I was curious to get an idea of what the phrase rural healthcare looked like, so I visited the health center, which serves as the clinic for Ajo residents. The center is housed in a single-story, sand-colored building that was originally the dormitory for single men at the New Cornelia copper mine. The miners' big rooms, which seemed about four times larger than any doctor's exam room I have ever visited, now hold examining tables, sinks, chairs, and counters placed liberally about as though to take up as much space as possible. Ajo had a grand hospital back in the mine's heyday. It now stands vacant on a hill above the town plaza. Today, the nearest functioning hospital to Ajo is about 100 miles away to the northeast, in the town of Casa Grande. There is another hospital on the Tohono O'odham Reservation, about 70 miles away in the little town of Sells. It is designated for tribal members only, although I was told it does receive non-tribal patients in emergencies. Jane Cannon had been at the clinic for 16 years when I met her. She's also the clinic's manager for quality improvement and for outreach to the community and beyond. She toured me around the clinic. It provides enviable one-stop shopping for many routine procedures that would have the rest of us traipsing all around our bigger hometowns for multiple appointments, including x-rays and lab work. There is also a well-stocked pharmacy, a dentist, and a behavioral health services team. The center also has a certified Spanish translator and a special phone line with third-party translators for multiple languages. As Cannon describes it, because of its remoteness, the clinic needs to be self-ready for a lot of circumstances, from an Ebola outbreak, unlikely, to backup for massive power failures, more likely. The local high school is set up with water, cots, and an emergency generator for electricity and cooling, and a strong community of support is nearby, including folks from the Border Patrol Station and from Organ Pipe and Cabeza Prieta. The Ajo Clinic is registered as a Federally Qualified Health Center, FQHC. The FQHC designation earns the clinic extra reimbursements for the 2/3 of its patients who are on Medicare or Medicaid, and allows it to participate in other benefits, being partners in an alliance of similar centers, receiving federal malpractice insurance coverage, and providing its patients with care from specialists like a visiting cardiologist and ophthalmologist. But it lacks the resources to serve everyone. For example, since there is no way to get prenatal care in Ajo, many pregnant women choose to put off those examinations and checkups for a while, and many will decamp to Tucson or Phoenix a few weeks before their due date. I asked Cannon about some of the worst problems for this rural community, and then without giving her a chance to answer, I guessed. Drugs, alcohol, violence. She confirmed and explained how these could spawn a vicious cycle of depression, lack of motivation, and even contribute to obesity and type 2 diabetes. The Tohono O'odham have the highest rate of adult-onset diabetes of anywhere in the world, a stunning 50%. If you're depressed and unmotivated, she told me, just getting up off the couch can seem like a major effort. One target for improving the quality of life in Ajo is food. One of the last things I expected to find was a thriving local agriculture and food movement in the middle of the Sonoran Desert. Conditions are about as challenging as you can imagine. Desert temperature with freezes in the winter and 110 degrees in the summer. Poor soil with low organic and microbial content, high alkalinity, and caliche, a natural cement, and 4 inches of rainfall annually, often arriving in downpours. Undeterred, the Ajo community has built an intricate cooperative network around food. Working together are the school, the clinic, local gardeners, the farmers market, local restaurants, the town's grocery store, student interns, adult volunteers, the food bank, the CSA, and the Sonoran Desert Conference Center with its spaces for gardens, a chicken coop, celebratory events, teaching and demonstration space, and a newly finished commercial kitchen. Aho's CSA was founded and has been run by Nina Sijovic, an attractive and